Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Take the Spurs game out of the equation. We've already covered why players back late, lack of fitness, that sort of thing. And this has turned into a pretty good start to the season for City. Norwich and Arsenal were comprehensively dispatched, but a tough test at Leicester on Saturday was well managed and well controlled. Tougher tests still remain though, and there's always the start of the Champions League group of death this week too. So let's waste no time and dive into it all. I'm David Mooney. This is the Athletic's Manchester City podcast, Why Always Us. And once again, I am joined by their City correspondent, Sam Lee. Hiya, Sam.
Hello. Is it the group of death? I mean, we'll get into that later on. But
well, I thought it was.
Still going to get out of that.
I thought it was the group of death. Is it not the group of death? It's the most exciting and tough group that City have had for a while.
Yeah. That's a low bar, isn't it? To be fair.
Well, it is.
I know City fans are quite excited. Look at the other groups.
What are the groups?
Liverpool's is immediately. Liverpool have got Atletico Madrid. I know they're not all like top names and top amazing teams. But obviously, Atletico Madrid, the Spanish champions. Porto, who are a big club in Portugal, and AC Milan. So that, you know, that's a big group, isn't it?
Mm. Okay, well, okay.
Bayern, Barca, Benfica, and then Dynamo Kiev. They're tough groups. I mean, it's a tough group, don't get me wrong. But you're not
having group of death, basically. Yeah, okay, fair enough.
City's still getting out of that. The two PSG games would be good, but anyway, that's the Champions League roundup done.
Yeah, well, we've no need to do that later on, but we'll crack on with some other stuff. You can sign up to The Athletic right now and read all of Sam's stuff on City, including a recent piece on Eliakim Mangala's debut. And honestly, it's one of my favourite things that, Sam, you've ever written, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a niche article.
Hopefully it will appeal to the listeners.
Yeah, I genuinely think it's one of the biggest falls from graces that I've ever seen at City. So go and check that out. If you sign up right now, you'll get a 33% discount on the price of a full subscription. Just go to theathletic.com/ManCityPod. So let's start with Leicester, Sam, on Saturday. I want to run something past you before we get into the actual details of the game. Because the thought struck me at half time on Saturday that I was getting a good vibe about the way that City were playing. And I'm hoping that you can kind of explain a little bit more about what that means, because I can't really put it into words what I mean by that. It's quite abstract. It doesn't really seem measurable in any stretch of, you know, any metrics don't seem to add up to what I mean by the way City are playing and making me feel good. It's kind of like what Guardiola says about when you can smell the goals, that sort of thing. It doesn't really mean anything, but you know what it means. And it all came about because I was nervous about the game ahead of it. I thought Leicester were a bigger and better challenge than any of the teams that City have faced to this point. You know, Vardy always scores. They always create chances on the break, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
The fans are back in as well. It was going to be a more hostile environment than they'd faced at anywhere possibly other than Spurs. But when you watch the performance, City were in control of a lot of the game. It was probably about as much as you could expect them to be in control of on a day like that. And then as half time was approaching, that thought kind of clicked into place that even if they didn't win, I wasn't getting the alarm bells that I've had in other seasons where they've had disappointing starts as defending champions, and you've thought, oh, there's problems here, and you can see where things are not quite connecting properly. I mean, the record would have been like played 4-1-2, lost 2 had they lost. But I wouldn't have been that worried about it in the same way that I would have been in kind of like 12-13, Mancini's last season, or 14-15, Pellegrini's middle season, the season where Liverpool won the title and it felt like Guardiola's City looked tired after the two back-to-back titles. In each of them, the warning signs weren't that they'd drop points, but the manner in which they were dropping points. Whereas this season, I kind of felt if City had lost at Leicester, the manner in which they dropped the points wouldn't have been that concerning because they were still playing quite well. I got to admit, I was a little bit nervous after the Spurs game. You know, but three performances on since then, they've really kind of set that feeling straight. And I'm getting this kind of smell of a good season, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote my article like immediately after the final whistle. That'll be obviously available for people to read now. Hopefully already read it. I was just trying to strike the right balance of, I don't want to say that everything's going to be fine because, like, you know, anything can happen now. It's ridiculously early. It's almost too early to even having this conversation. But it's like there's obviously good signs, and probably more in the context of, like you said, maybe issues that could have crept in and after the Spurs game. I was never bothered after the Spurs game. I didn't even write about that match really. You know, I did the focus on Grealish, and I would imagine after the game we just talked about how, you know, it doesn't matter. You know? I know I said that a lot last season for various reasons, but with pre-season all the distraction and stuff, it didn't bother me that City had lost in terms of what it meant for the season. And yeah, obviously since then they've been really good. The 2-5-0 wins, like the Norwich and Arsenal played into City's hands, but you don't just accidentally win 5-0. You know what I mean? Like there was obviously something there, but the Leicester game was that word again. It was a big bellwether. I was really interested to see. And again,
that's just an in joke from about 9 months ago. Funny. Yeah, it's always going to be.
Yeah,
funny.
Well, you say in joke, but like enough people read it.
Yeah.
Well, listen to it. But yeah, so because Leicester, like you say, and this is kind of the premise of my article, Leicester, if there's any weaknesses in City, Leicester are going to find them. That seems to be how you can kind of quantify the game and the performance.
Yeah.
Like whether it was 2019-20, which to be fair, the results might not stack up there, but go with it. But obviously the start of last season, whenever Vardy's got those goals, is it 10 goals in 8 games or 8 goals in 10 games? They're all on counter-attacks. You know, Leicester will just find out if City aren't quite at it. And the fact that City, they controlled the game very well. I wouldn't, you know, it wasn't as like complete as April, but it was never going to be because, you know, in April there was no fans and slightly different vibe, but with the atmosphere like it was on Saturday and just everything that brings, and, you know, Leicester were up for it. They were up for the counter-attacks and stuff. And to go back to one thing you said about how, yeah, if City had have lost the game, because there were opportunities for Leicester on the counter-attack, it wasn't, oh, you know, this is City's big problem striking again. There wasn't, you know, the problems against Tottenham at the start of the season, which we know about. You know, they gave the ball away half the pitch. They got counted on. It didn't go well. But, you know, there were reasons for that. Individuals playing and fitness and stuff. That wasn't the issue. So when you talk about the kind of smell of the performance and it feeling good, City, I think a part of that obviously probably could be quantified with XG in terms of the chances City created. But it could also just be quantified by the fact that they weren't giving the ball away stupidly and chasing back behind, like, towards their own goal endlessly. Like, Leicester did have counter-attacks and Leicester could have scored. And, like, Brendan Rodgers felt like it could have been 1-1. I felt it could have been 1-1 as well. Obviously, at the same time, I felt it could have been 3 or 4-0 to City. But those counter-attacks that they had, apart from the Vardy goal that was disallowed for offside, which was just, that was a classic kind of City making a stupid decision and getting punished. The rest was just Leicester being good. And, like, we analyse football so much, and especially when you've got a club focus, we talk about, you know, whether City is so good or City is so bad, whatever it is. But you obviously got to remember the opposition's part that they played. But that I tweeted about it, and I'll put it in my article, but that header from Harvey Barnes from basically the edge of the box that hit the bar after a counter-attack, there wasn't much City could have done about that. I'm sure it would have been analysed as, oh yeah, Leicester have done City on the counter-attack again, and they would have, but Leicester were just really good at it. Like that's why they're always in the top four conversation these days, because like they're a really good team. And while you've got Arsenal and Norwich who played into City's hands, Leicester will not play into City's hands at all. It's the opposite. It's like that's why City generally find it really hard against Leicester. And I'm sure loads of people go into the game or waiting to watch the game were thinking this is going to be really hard, and it was really hard. So yeah, but I mean with that counter attack chance, Schmeichel's pass out wide to Albrighton first was great. Albrighton just did a good little flick that you couldn't really, like, even if you close him down even quicker, like I just don't think there's any way you can be on the scene for that. And then Castagne did exactly the same thing, which Laporte fouled him and he was booked, and obviously the ref played advantage, but he could have taken a different decision. And then like all of a sudden Vardy was in, and it's like there's like Leicester just done really well there. But like there was other times when, you know, they went through towards the end and Edison made a good save, and there was always that danger. And I'm sure in the way that football fans think, I'm sure City fans would have been thinking right until the end, God, Leicester are going to score here. And that danger was always there. But it was quite often more the threat that something was going to happen rather than it actually happening.
Yeah.
Full of chances, was there? There wasn't a hatful of Leicester chances. Like there were good opportunities, don't get me wrong. But there wasn't loads and loads and loads.
Well, this is kind of, I guess, where the feeling comes from after the game as well. Because, I mean, I should caveat all this as well by saying that last season, up until about January, I was getting the smell of a bad season. So, like, it doesn't necessarily follow that things will work quite well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but, like, you say that, like, the chances as well. Like a little insight into kind of how football highlights, I assume, are put together based on one of my previous jobs. I used to, this is going to sound like it's come from left field, but go with it. I used to work for a company that did the highlights of Arsenal's youth games. So me and a cameraman used to drive down to Arsenal's training ground from Manchester on a Saturday morning. He'd film the game, I'd watch the game, and I'd rate all of the chances that happened out of 10. And that meant when the footage got back to the editors in the edit suite in Manchester, they'd just look at my notes and go, well, we've got this amount of time. We'll take all the eights, nines and tens, and that'll make the highlights. And when you look at what Leicester did, there's so many opportunities there where you think, oh, there's a really good chance coming here. But then Diaz steps in, or Laporte steps in, or Rodri there's a little block somewhere that just cuts the pass out and it breaks down. You think, well, that's not going to make the highlights reel. But all the way through the game, you're feeling really tense about it. And I guess that's that kind of sense of relief is what I'm talking about now, where I say that it feels like it could have been 1-1, like you say. But actually, when you look at the highlights, there's not many Leicester chances in there.
Yeah, and it's like, and look, it's not really doing down Leicester's performance. It's just kind of focused on how well City did. And like, even though I'm saying, oh, City did really well, apart from these chances, like, what do you expect? Like, really, to go to the King Power and not have counterattacks? Like, it's very rare. I thought you were going to say, when you're talking about how they choose highlights, like Ferran Torres' one-on-one wasn't on Match of the Day. I watched it this morning. I was like, oh, shit. I was like, was Torres' one-on-one after it was 1-0? Because I just thought, surely they wouldn't miss that chance out. But it was one of those where, and I think also on Match of the Day, they try and find as many chances for both teams as possible. But then that did make me think, if anyone's watching this, people might think City were quite lucky out of it. But I don't think they were overall. Like, I think it was a really good win. And I've kind of talked for the usual 5-minute monologue already about, you know, City's good stuff. But that's more in terms of avoiding bad stuff. Like stopping Leicester from doing what they do. And that's really important, because it goes back to what Guardiola was saying about patience. And if City are suffering counterattacks, then it smells like a bad game and it smells like a bad season, doesn't it? You know, and it might still happen. They got Chelsea, PSG and Liverpool in a week. And, you know, we might be having completely different conversations after that. But even so, it would still be early.
Yeah.
But the other side of it was City just created so many chances. City did control the game really well. Leicester make it really difficult to play through the middle of them. So City just kind of worked it out wide, and good combinations between Grealish and Bernardo. There were loads of chances. Leicester, again, you know, it wasn't like, because when it looked like Leicester might score, and obviously when Vardy did, and I didn't notice at first that the flag had gone up, it hadn't quite got to the stage where it was like while they were asking for that, because so many times when I've tweeted and had to write about City games where they've lost, it's like, well, of course. Of course this has happened, lads, because you've missed too many chances. Like, it didn't quite feel like it. A bit towards the end of the first half, I was like, it's getting a bit like that. But a lot of it, again, it was just Leicester defending really well. Like, those goal-mouth scrambles, Leicester were just chucking themselves all in the way.
Yeah,
there was a couple of Jesus ones.
He should have scored, and then the two follow-ups from that, I kind of have sympathy with that they didn't score. I think the Jesus one, he should have scored, but other than that, yeah.
And then, I mean, but then Torres' one-on-one was like, that was probably the one where I was thinking, uh-oh, they're going to score here, just because of how football works. But then the other chances, really, the main ones were towards the end when City could have made it 2-0 or 3-0. They had so many chances, and it was one of those where, again, they won't even end up on Match of the Day. But like you said, for when you were talking about Leicester breaking, but one of the City defenders stopping it, City had so many chances, like on kind of transitions, but they just make such terrible decisions, don't they? It's like they're just so unclinical in those situations, and not even in terms of the finishing, but even getting a chance sometimes. Like, because Sterling didn't do well when he came on, it just didn't go well, that substitute. But there was one towards the end where City were, I don't know if it was 4-on-3 or 4-on-4 or whatever. But he made a, so Gundogan was carrying the ball forward and Bernardo was to the left. I'm trying to think it would have been to the right at that stage. But they all kind of, like, it was a promising break, but none of them were really doing anything. And then Sterling got on the scene and really motored through between Gundogan and whoever was on the right. But Gundogan was looking left and he went to Bernardo and he kind of went wide, and Bernardo was like, okay, we'll just keep hold of it then. And it's like, if, to be fair, if they'd have given it to Sterling in that situation, he would have at least been able to miss the one-on-one. Like, he would have been able to at least, like, make amends for everything else. When Grealish went through at the end and had like one bad touch and then another bad touch and ended up going too wide and the finish was just bad. And again, I was surprised when Fernandinho went through and didn't square it. Like, Fernandinho going for goal in that situation, you just think Fernandinho was probably the one player, possibly De Bruyne, but possibly Gundogan. But there's not many, but he's probably the one player you'd think, well, he's not going to shoot when you could just pass it across and finish the game and it's 2-0. Yeah. And obviously he went for the far post. It's like, oh God, what are they doing? But obviously in the end it was fine. And
I thought you were going to go with,
didn't really do too much after that. But
yeah, I thought you were going to go with Fernandinho will be the most unlikely scorer on that pitch. And I mean, aside from Edison, who would you say was the most unlikely scorer? I'd have gone Kyle Walker, to be honest, but here we are.
It would be Walker, wouldn't it, to be fair?
But Fernandinho would be quite
Fernandinho
high on
in that number eight position is great. Like, yeah. It was interesting because he did that against was Everton last game of the season, which was obviously like party atmosphere. Aguero's got his two goals, which were largely to do with Fernandinho. But you think, we're not going to see Fernandinho as an eight again. But when he came on against Leicester in a game where, you know, you think he's just going to sit in with Rodri and stop Leicester attacking, like it was really interesting. I mean, I don't know if he'd have the legs to do it for 90 minutes. And also, I don't think there's any point when you've got
the players ahead
of
him,
and you've got De Bruyne coming back. But I mean, it's a hell of an option late in the game.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about the control in that game, because, well, I mean, what was it that made City so much more in control of it? Because, like, as we've said the number of times where Leicester had chances to create chances but didn't, like, it can't just simply be that, you know, Rodri played well, that Laporte and Diaz played well. Do you know what I mean? There must have been something to it that meant the setup was right for City to take control of that game, was it?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe I've done that classic journalism thing of like latching onto one particular idea and saying, this is what we know about, so therefore it's the most important thing. But obviously Guardiola was talking about patience a lot last season, and particularly with those Leicester games. And, you know, when they went 1-0 up at the Etihad last year and they were just like kind of spamming the ball forward, trying to rush it and get a second goal. And obviously, you know, the more you rush it, the more you're out of position, the more the pass is mislaid. And then, you know, you're not in a position to then go and counter press, are you? And then all Leicester don't, like, you really need to do counter press Leicester because they can play around you so well, as we've discussed. So when you've got space to play into, it's a disaster. And that's why it was a disaster at the Etihad last year. And then obviously they went back to the King Power, 1-2-0, kept the ball, which is what they did against Gladbach. They did it against Dortmund, to a slightly lesser extent against PSG. But that's how they controlled those games, just by keeping the ball and being in the right positions and having the ball in the opposition half and being clinical. And that's what they did on Saturday. They weren't rushing it, were they? It was kind of the right pass at the right time. And I'm trying to think the difference with Tottenham. Obviously, you've got, you know, fatigue and making bad decisions. I mean, Mendy played, and as everyone knows, he was terrible. And it, like, just quite simply. So when you said it can't be as simple as these players playing well, like, how it often did Mendy give the ball away to, like, a Spurs midfielder, and the Spurs midfielder went, okay, then Son, crack on. You know, it was as simple as that. Spurs were really well organised, and so were Leicester. But City just seemed to make better decisions in their passes. I can't think there were too many misplaced passes anywhere. And if there were, it wasn't even the ones. The example I always use for this, and there's probably better, but we're talking about 2019-20 and how things don't quite click. Obviously, City lost to Norwich on this weekend, actually. And then they lost to Wolves in October, didn't they, at the Etihad?
Yeah.
And both examples of those were City losing the ball in the final third. So you think, oh, it's not too dangerous. But they lost the ball in the final third. Everyone was ahead of the ball. And Wolves just rampaged down the other end. But even when City were losing the ball in the final third, they were kind of there to disrupt it if it broke down or it was going out of play. And obviously, Leicester couldn't turn them around so quickly. And it just seemed like, to me anyway, they were just using the ball more intelligently. And often, you know, they were actually creating the chances. You know, if they weren't losing the ball, obviously they were keeping it and they were getting into the box and forcing dangerous situations. So I think that's how they managed to do it. You know, everyone was just doing what they needed to do and they were in the right place to do it. And again, if we're talking about what this means for the season, I don't want to say the season's going to be great because of this game, but it does show that City have started well. You know, if talking about complacency and stuff, and look, maybe that kicks in, or maybe they get in some negative spiral if they get a couple of unlucky results like happened a couple of years ago. But they have found that rhythm. And going back to what you said right at the start about getting the sense that it's going to be a good season, or, you know, that intangible feeling of watching City, to me, it felt like, okay, yeah, that's City. It felt like you felt comfortable watching it in terms of...
It was their identity,
exactly.
You could see it, yeah.
And like, so because of various reasons, I had to, like, I couldn't spend all day and all night writing an article after the game, like I have done recently with those analysis of, you know, Jesus and Torres and Grealish. It took taking me hours afterwards, but I couldn't yesterday. And I was thinking, I was trying to plan every possible eventuality and, like, what would I write for this? What would I write for that? And I was thinking, you know, if they lose, I'm probably going to be able to start writing with 20 or 30 minutes left of this game, because we know what happens when City lose. Like, it's not going to be a last minute winner, is it, for the other team? It's going to be, they might score in the first half, they might score in the second, and then City will have a load of the ball, and they won't do anything with it, and then the game will just peter out. And I was like, if that were to happen, and look, before the game, I didn't know if that was going to happen or not. You know, it's Leicester, it could have, and it's City early in the season, we don't know too much, it could have happened. And I was just thinking, well, if they lose, it'll probably be like that. But again, just to go back to how that obviously clearly was not the case. And when you watch a City performance, it's like a malfunctioning system, isn't it? We've talked about this so many times. Like, they're all trying to do the same things. They're all trying to take up the same positions and make the same runs and make the same passes. But it's not been working for an hour. But it's the only thing they've got. It's the only thing they've been taught for 5 years. So they just keep doing it and it doesn't work. And it's like a malfunctioning system. And that's why it's kind of like it's a typical City defeat, because even that follows a pattern.
Yeah.
But it's not the good... you know, the good City that we've seen in the three title winning seasons and in their better matches, even when, you know, they've not won the leagues. But that performance yesterday was a proper City performance. And look, I'm trying so hard not to be like kind of like results based. And look, maybe if Leicester had a score, I don't know, I'd have been saying, oh, our problems are here, problems that. But I don't know, I don't think so. Like you said, during the game, like if Leicester had a score, if it was that how Harvey Barnes had it, you'd say, well, fair play, like, what are you going to do? And then we'd probably end up talking about, so you need a striker, to be fair. Because that's the only other element of the game, isn't it? Where it's like, yeah, everything's in place here, so you're looking pretty solid. They know what they're doing. The players are obviously hungry. So many quality players on the bench will come in now. You know, now they're playing three games they're playing a game over 3 days. So that's all great. That's all taken care of. But obviously, like, the clinical side of it is something to discuss, isn't it?
Yeah, but it has been for a while. That's that's the take home. I mean, the other side from the game on Saturday, Bernardo Silva was the one who he seemed to grab all the headlines because, I mean, he was having a great game before, even before he scored. It's even in the sense that it's almost easy to forget from that performance that De Bruyne and Foden are there ready to come back from injury in the next kind of few weeks. And I want to focus on Bernardo a little bit because him and Grealish.
Yes, definitely should do.
Yeah, well, him and Grealish. I was getting, again, an intangible sense that they're working really well together.
Yeah. It was interesting, wasn't it, that Bernardo played on that left side of the attacking midfield too, which he's never really done. And that's not a Pauza thing or anything like that. It's just, well, I suppose it is really, because if De Bruyne is always playing on the other side. But this was more because, and that, this time Gundogan was playing, so the Pauza was still there in theory, although he played quite high up. But Gundogan was just on the right, which, again, you don't see very often. But I asked Guardiola about that, and he was saying he just wanted somebody left-footed on that left side. He was like, the way he was talking about it was like, I kind of got the vibe, and maybe I'll need to listen to it again, but he was like, oh, in the last few years, everybody wants inverted wingers. Like, he was like, it was that kind of thing where everybody says we spend too much, or everybody, like, you know, where he was kind of criticizing the media or like pundits or whatever. And I was like, well, you're the one who wants inverted wingers. Like, you are doing this, but maybe I read it wrong. But he was kind of like, oh, in the last few years, everybody likes inverted wingers, but I still like to have people on there playing on their strong foot on that side. So we put Bernardo in there, and he could put, you know, instead of coming inside onto his right foot, which would have been the case with Gundogan, and obviously is the case with Cancelo, Bernardo can just cross the ball in straight away. And obviously, if you've got Torres making those runs as a number nine, then you can see how that fits together. I mean, obviously, he could just play a left foot on the left wing if he wanted, and we'll probably see that with Foden's back, to be fair. As for their partnership, yeah, it's like, I've been saying it a lot, but I'm looking forward to Grealish and Foden because they're so technical, they're so fluid, they're so slick. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that looks. But like I said, Grealish's partnerships with so many other players, like I mentioned Sterling, but Bernardo now is on that side. That's not one I'll mention because I didn't think they'd come into the same areas too often. But now they're there, you can absolutely see why. And yeah, like it was really good. And once, you know, Grealish gets a bit more of a cutting edge, which I'm sure will come, then I'm sure it'll be even more devastating. They did look really good. And yeah, Bernardo, like, I've said this before, and this is a minor point that only really applies to me, but you're all going to have to listen to it anyway. But I'm so glad Guardiola admitted at the start of the season that Bernardo wanted to leave. Because if he hadn't have said that, I reckon 90% of people would have said, absolute bollocks, there's no way he wanted to leave. Because if you look at everything else, like, he didn't leave, obviously. So that's enough for most people. If you say somebody might go and they don't, it's easy just to think, well, that was bollocks. But like, if you look at the way he's been playing, if you look at the way he celebrated that goal, if you look at what he said after the game, I love this club, I love being here, blah, blah, blah. You would just think, this guy, there was nothing ever there. But I mean, to make this actually more relevant and to give more context to his performance, obviously Guardiola did say he did want to go. So we know that's a fact. But the thing was, and the thing I'd reported over the summer anyway, is Guardiola never really wanted him to. Because he knows that...
Yeah. I mean, this was...
Guardiola knows that he can... that Bernardo's always going to play well because obviously he wanted to go last summer, but nobody ever knew. And he had a great season last year. And Guardiola knows that even if he's not entirely happy, he's going to be so important on the pitch. And that's what we're seeing now.
Well, this was genuinely going to be my next question to you because I wanted to clear up the story around him simply because what I was seeing a lot of on social media during the game and in the reaction to Bernardo's performances from people who weren't in the City bubble was the talk that City were looking to trying to offload him last summer. And I didn't feel that was particularly true. I kind of get the impression that City were saying, well, listen, if you want to leave, then you can leave, but we'd rather you didn't leave, yeah. If that makes sense.
I mean, yeah, it's a difficult one because it's like they were so mainly in they, you know, he was most likely to go because he wanted to, he'd gone about it in the right way, you know, so there was no animosity. He hadn't been a dick last season. So they're like, well, fair enough. You know, you did stay and do well. So if you get a move, you can go. But there was also the element although, like what I've said about Guardiola, notwithstanding, you know, Guardiola did think, well, it'd be great to keep him because he's a great player and he's a great guy. Whereas, you know, some others that have been like, yeah, it's not so much of a problem if they move on. But like, it was a problem with squad space, wasn't it? So they did need to move somebody on, you know, to raise a bit of money towards other things and to keep the balance of the squad, because, you know, I've talked about how the last season ended in terms of the players' feelings towards the manager and feelings about wanting to stay at the club or not. Obviously, it didn't make too much of a difference on the pitch, which is fantastic for the club. But behind the scenes, you know, there were those feelings. But now, competition for places has only increased, because especially with Bernardo, because like Grealish is in there. And we've not seen it yet, really. Like Sterling's obviously struggling to start games. So is Mahrez, which is interesting, given how they finished last season in terms of attitude. But obviously, like Foden's not been around, and now there's De Bruyne. So there's going to be a lot of competition there. So to bring it back to Bernardo, City were like, well, we do need to get rid of someone. We do need to get money in. We do need to free up a squad space. And Bernardo does want to go, and he's most likely to get an offer. So, yeah, like it did get to the stage of, it's not ideal, but we need this guy to go to make things happen. And like, it wasn't my information, to be fair, on Ronaldo, but it's been reported by other people who I consider to be reliable. But part of the Ronaldo thing, obviously, once Kane was out the window, and we'll go back to Kane in a minute, was City. Part of that equation was City needed to get somebody to go. So it's like, yeah, City didn't look at the whole squad and say, I'll tell you who we should sell, Bernardo Silva, get him out. But because he wanted to go, it was like, well, okay, if we've got to sell someone, so it may as well be him. So it's a complicated one. But yeah, they were looking to sell him. But, you know, for like understandable reasons, they weren't trying to bomb him out against his will. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
As for Kane, I was speaking to someone the other day who knows him, and basically it got to a couple of days before he put out the statement saying he was staying, and he hadn't spoken to Joe Lewis, the Spurs owner. He said, "What?" So Joe Lewis is obviously Daniel Levy is the everyone. Well, Daniel Levy is Daniel Levy, as Pep Guardiola might say, but Joe Lewis is the one who's, you know, nobody comes or goes without Joe Lewis having his say. And Kane hadn't spoke to him, which again ties into the whole, you know, what were they playing at narrative. And he spoke to Joe Lewis and he was like, well, yeah, you can go. I said, you're going to pay 200 million. He was like, well, no, they might pay 150. He was like, well, if they're not paying 200 million, have a good season. You'll be staying with us. And that was it. Like I said, I don't know then from the same source, but Wood would have then got back to City, shall we say, and said, well, this is what Spurs want. And so they would have said, it's not happening. So,
yeah.
So forget
let's,
it. So
that's kind
of a bit more meat on the bones of how that happened. So, yeah, they moved on, obviously, to Ronaldo, and, you know, whatever happened. But I think in the end, most City fans are happy. Well, I don't know about most, but a lot of City fans are happy that Ronaldo didn't sign, aren't they? I still think it would have been a great and fascinating signing, but I appreciate I'm looking at that from a kind of media point of view rather than a kind of fan thing. So
I'm not going to sit here and talk for all City fans. I couldn't possibly. But what I am going to say is I'm quite happy with where City squad is right now. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house, everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With that in mind, and with, as you say, about competition for places, Sam, let's talk about that group of death that begins this week. As City obviously host RB Leipzig. And again, I've said host there, which is a completely wanky way of putting it, but, you know, it's what we have to say.
I don't think anybody would have noticed.
Well, you know, it's smooth. That's all we do. I'm honestly, I'm really excited about this group. It's been years that where the group stages have been dull, they've had very little jeopardy, and you know, like the classic example is that year where they lost to, was it Lyon in the opening game, and then after that game you weren't thinking, oh well, that's a terrible start to the Champions League campaign. You're thinking, well, they've got five games to go on and win the group, and they did. Whereas I kind of get the impression this time around, it's not going to be that easy. They've obviously got the Ligue 1 runners-up PSG. They've got the Bundesliga runners-up Leipzig. And they've got, I mean, Belgian League is not the top tier, let's say, but Bruges won it.
And yeah, you don't have to be cheeky. You don't have to be cheeky and be overly respectful.
Yeah, but Bruges won. They did win the Belgian League. So it's not an easy group to get out of this year, and there's going to be interesting games. And I've always said with the Champions League that it gets interesting from February, because that's when the big ties start to happen. And this year it feels like the big ties are going to happen a bit earlier. So competition for places is probably quite a good thing in this sense, because if they play in three games a week, they can rotate the front three for each one of them and have a pretty good team there.
Yeah, they can rotate everyone. Obviously, last season... that's how Pep kind of did it. He kind of had it feels disrespectful to call them a B team because they were very good, but that's how Stones got into the team, wasn't it? Because Stones was playing really well in those midweek cup games, whether it was Champions League or Carabao Cup, and Laporte had that bit of a dip, and it just got to the stage where it's like, well, Stones is playing really well, so I'll play him in the league games, because it was basically like City's strongest 11 was the league team, wasn't it? And obviously at the end of the season, City's strongest 11 was the Champions League team, you know, if you're thinking Foden keeping Sterling out of this team and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, Pep will just keep rotating. Yeah, I suppose it's interesting with the Champions League, because there is always a threat of a team nicking a draw at the Etihad. It seems to happen quite often, actually, doesn't it? Like, there was obviously, Lyon won at the Etihad, didn't they, a couple of years ago. City beat Porto last season, but I don't remember it being a great game. And Porto obviously dug in really well. And obviously, Leipzig, I suppose it's a little bit like the Leicester game in terms of, you know, they'll be having a go, and if City have got any weaknesses, they might find them. And obviously, if you drop points at home in this group and you've got two games against PSG coming up, then it does change the complexion of things, and it obviously adds more jeopardy to the group, there being another big club in there who could easily win the group. And the other thing that Guardiola has said in the past, and I think a lot of people have latched onto, is, especially when City was struggling to get past the kind of first big knockout game they played, you know, Guardiola and others had said, maybe if they had a big game earlier on in the group stage, they'd be more used to, because Guardiola's always big on the history, isn't it? The history of the club in the competition. And he's like Real Madrid and Liverpool and Bayern Munich, you know, they've been doing it for 60 odd years, and City have been doing it for 10 in terms of the Champions League. So maybe those experiences of big nights where you've not got to win, but it's a very good idea if you do, you know, against top players, those experiences help. So yeah, playing PSG will help. The timing of the away PSG game, not ideal.
Yeah, that could be better, couldn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, there's so many quality players. He's not going to be able to play all, you know, let's say he's established already, for argument's sake, like a top choice 11 like he did at the start of last season or at the end. He's not going to be able to play each and every one of those in every game. But, like, we know the situation. Like, De Bruyne hasn't been playing this season, and City have been great anyway. And when De Bruyne was injured in January, February, and people were like, oh, maybe that derails him, and then Bernardo came back in, and we had that debate. Well, I didn't really think it was much of a debate, but, you know, there's a conversation to be had, I suppose, about whether City are better with or without De Bruyne. Like, they are so good with and without, that De Bruyne doesn't have to play every game if they're managing his ankle injury. He doesn't have to play, even though it's Chelsea, PSG and Liverpool, they could rest him there. And like, we've got Grealish has done well on the left and linked up well with Bernardo, but you could play Foden in one of those games or two of those games, or, you know, you could play him in three. If he's not fit enough to play him in three, then you could take him out for a couple and put Grealish back in. You've got Sterling as well. Admittedly, Sterling would have to play better. On the right, you've got Mahrez and Jesus, who are obviously good options. They could play with Torres as a number nine. They could obviously bring in one of these attacking midfielders as a false nine and mix it up that way. They have got so many options. Again, you could play Stones and Diaz. You could play Diaz and Laporte. I mean, I would imagine Diaz would play all three games, but you could play Laporte and Stones. I'm still very happy to see Zinchenko at left back, but you could obviously play Cancelo as well. I'd imagine Walker would probably play all three games, but I'd imagine there'd be some people listening to this thinking it would be good to see Cancelo at right back again. It's like, the squad is so good. Like, Fernandinho could come in for one of those games, maybe the PSG one.
Yeah.
Maybe people would want him to come in for two or three listening to this. But the squad is ridiculous. And yeah, it's an incredible run of games. I'm going to write an article about how you prepare for it generally and specifically in terms of City, because it's basically you're playing the three best teams in the world in 8 days, which is mad, all away from home. But like, if anyone can handle it, it's City, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
that's like it, between Guardiola and the players at his disposal, they're just in incredible strength and depth. Like, they've had this start to the season, which we've been talking about, without De Bruyne and without Foden, and now Foden's obviously phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm that's what I say. I'm excited by it, and I think it's I think it's the first time in a long time when I look at the group stage and think this will be fun. There's a sense of irony to it, I guess, because I was one of the big shouters in back about 2012 when City drew the group of champions, where City went in as Premier League champions, they drew Real Madrid as Spanish champions, Borussia Dortmund as German champions, and Ajax as Dutch champions, and finished bottom of the group. And I kind of got the impression that if it didn't start the ball rolling for the reform of how the group stage draw was done, it certainly kind of kicked the ball on a little bit. And now I feel now I understand how wrong that was, because this is an interesting group this year, and they don't have to play bloody Shakhtar time and again. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I think it'll be an entertaining run. And even though it's Chelsea away, PSG away, Liverpool away, the only one that bothers me there is Liverpool away, and that's because it's City. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. When City won Anfield last year, I was like, oh, next year people will be like, oh, well, that almost didn't count because there was no fans. But even I'm now thinking, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it is with the fans back in.
Yeah.
That'll be the classic, won't it? Like, Bravo will end up in goal again somehow, and
yeah. Oh, God.
It'd be 4-0 yeah. after 20 minutes, and they'd have been scored from an average distance of about 27.8 yards. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, plenty of time for things to fall apart before then. Just a quick question on the Champions League before we finish, Sam. How much does a tougher Champions League group affect the Premier League campaign? Because obviously we talked about the fact they've got strength in depth. In previous years, like, you take a look at last season, they obviously had a lot of the group stage last season were games that they were probably going to win, and so, like you said, Guardiola
the
rotated
group stage
his team.
Crap last year, wasn't it?
Yeah. But they could focus still on making sure they didn't slip up in the Premier League, especially when they weren't playing particularly well and they were grinding out results. Obviously, they're playing well at the moment, they're winning games, but they've got a tough group as well. Does it change any of the dynamics, or am I overthinking it all?
I think as long as there's not loads of injuries, because it's one of those where you could look at the same situation, and whether you're pessimistic or optimistic or positive or negative, you could put it whichever way you want, and you could say, oh, well, you know, they can't rest too many players because they're gonna need a lot of bodies, and it could tire them out, and you know, they could take their eye off the ball in the Premier League. Or you could look at it and say that rhythm of being up for every game is going to be useful. You know,
they've thrived on that in the past, haven't they?
Exactly. Normally they want to run in, to be fair, and the fact that they're doing it so early in the season, I don't know, like, might tire them out at Christmas, maybe, but. Going back to what I was saying earlier, in terms of the ability in that squad, and we know how Guardiola handled it last season by basically playing a different 11 in the week. Okay, you might not be able to do that too much, but with the Carabao Cup, well, this is the interesting thing about Wickham, actually, because the Wickham game is before that run against Chelsea, and I'm wondering, maybe a lot of kids will play, or maybe instead of two or three, maybe it'll be three or four. And then you'll have some of the players, you know, like Fernandinho, Zinchenko, Stones. Maybe they'll come in. But I'm wondering how many Pep will choose to use in terms of the youth players, just to give a rest to the other lads before, and how many first team players he'll use to give them a bit of rhythm in case they then come in against PSG a week later. That'll be interesting how that all works in terms of like periodization and keeping that rhythm.
Yeah,
but
it'll be like
I'm gonna
game.
Have to take the positive.
Not yeah, Oxford. Yeah. Who was it? Not it wasn't Oxford, was it? Who was it? The
Burton.
That's the one. Yeah.
I think I'm going to go with a positive route because the squad at the moment is so strong, but everyone's at the moment is fit. Like De Bruyne's just coming back, Foden's just coming back. I think even if he did a heavily rotated or like made five or six changes to a team, it's still going to be really strong. Against Wickham, you can make loads of changes. Against Bruges, you can make five or six. Chelsea, Liverpool, PSG. And then an international break is tricky because if Diaz plays all three games and then he goes and plays two or three games with Portugal, then bit of a nightmare. But you'd think a bit of common sense would prevail there. And yeah, I just think it'll help keep them in a rhythm. They've got a big enough squad to deal with it. Like, that's the bottom line, really. I could have just saved 5 minutes of waffle and just said, the squad's so good. Like, sometimes I look at it too kind of sensitively and just be like, oh, well, there's this and there's this. But like sometimes or you just need the zoomed out view and you just need to look at it how like a Leicester fan would look at it or like a Bournemouth fan or something. And you just go, they've got a fucking unbelievable collection of players. Like they'll probably be all right. That's probably the simple answer.
Yeah, yeah. Final point for this week's show, Sam. Something interesting's happened this week. A few fans got together on Twitter to set up a new account, MCFCIST, standing for obviously Manchester City Independent Supporters Trust. I'm going to read out the first two tweets because it basically said, this has been a long time coming. City are the only club in the Premier League top six who don't have an Independent Supporters Trust. There have been numerous ongoings in recent times where it seemed that fans haven't been consulted with. This needs to change. Will take a while to get off the ground, and I'm certain it will take a long time for us to get in line into the club, but a bit of persistence will get there. It's an interesting move, this, Sam, isn't it? Because obviously there was the issues with the mobile tickets over the summer. This has all kicked off the back of the fact that it's emerged the cup tickets are not transferable. And obviously there's a couple of groups like City Matters, there's the 1894 group, and it kind of feels like there's been nobody speaking up for the fans in this instance.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what the 1894 group say. Like, and in terms of the politics of the situation and their duties, I mean, I should know more about it and their responsibilities, really. I'm off this week. The people will be listening to this. So I do plan on writing about this more. I do intend to speak to 1894 to see, you know, their role in it, you know, what if they think it's necessary or whatever. But yeah, there are obviously fans. This is why it's been set up. So it's a fact that there are obviously fans that think not enough's been said. I've seen it talked about. I've not actually seen any backlash to it because last few days have been quite manic. Apparently, there's been a bit of backlash to the idea from, I'm fair to say, there's an element of City fans who think the club can do no wrong, which is, you know, you get the same anywhere. It's not really a criticism of City fans. It's just this particular element. I don't really mind if they get charged extra because they can see it's because of inflation or it's because of the quality on the pitch and we keep winning and blah, blah, blah. So that's fine. But there are that element of fans who think, well, we don't really need this kind of stuff. But obviously, there is obviously a growing number of fans who think, City are taking the piss here. And obviously that last week with it saying there's no cup scheme for the cups, which again, as I understand it, and I could be wrong here, so I could be talking rubbish, but as I understand it, that wasn't made clear when people kind of signed up to the cup scheme. Is that right?
Yeah, basically,
years fans didn't know they couldn't swap their tickets.
Yeah, in years gone by, you could swap your tickets because obviously you had the card and you could pass it on to friends and family, that sort of thing. This year, you can't do that because I think the Man City help statement was basically saying it was to stop people collecting points for games they've not been to effectively.
Yeah, which again, I can see that. Like, I can see that from the outside, but also I've seen so many complaints on my timeline. And look, I saw a load of complaints about the mobile ticketing, and which I wasn't really having. I thought, look, people will get it on their phone, they'll get it on their watch. In my opinion, there was too much people going, oh, I'm all right, but what about Dave from Moston, who's 85 and hasn't got a phone? I was like, you're imagining people who are going to have problems here. And like, there are obviously going to be a few, but I never thought the ticketing issue, mobile ticketing, would be that big. And it's fair to say, although there are a couple of problems with it, the first game of the season against Norwich, it was nowhere near as bad as people thought, was it? people thought it was going to be a shit show, and it wasn't. It was fine. So in terms of that kind of on my timeline, I'm not just believing everything I see because I wasn't really having it with that. But on my timeline with this, in terms of the ticket transfer, everyone's saying, well, you can get a ticket to a couple of games anyway. Like, and maybe City are thinking now we might be in the Champions League final again and we want to reward people who are there. But it seems like the reality of the situation is whether you go to these Champions League or League Cup games in October, November or not, and you want to go to the Cup semi-finals and the finals, you're probably going to be able to go anyway. So is there any point in changing it? So I think it sounds like a good idea because City might say, oh, we want to do it for this reason. And it makes a bit of sense. But that makes sense to me who doesn't have to buy City tickets and I don't have to put them on I don't have to give them away if I can't make it in midweek. So it makes sense to have fans who are actually impacted the other way. So yeah, it makes sense. I'm interested to see how it pans out.
Well, just for a bit of context on that, in terms of my season tickets, I dropped out of the cup schemes a couple of years ago because, long story short, I didn't have trouble getting tickets to the games that I wanted to go to. There were some games that fell on nights when I was working and it was almost impossible to get to. And so I figured it was probably just better to buy the ones that I wanted to go to and that was it. And take my chances if City get to a final and I'm not able to go. As it stands, I didn't try to go to the Champions League final last year. Obviously, that was a bit different with COVID and reduced capacities, all that sort of stuff. I imagine if they get to the Champions League final this year, I probably won't be able to get a ticket for it. Mm. But I've never struggled to get a ticket for a Wembley final or a Wembley semi-final for games that I've wanted to go to. So that's kind of the chance that I take with it all. And I think a lot of people are maybe thinking along similar lines for future seasons now with the fact that they can't transfer the tickets.
Yeah, exactly. It's difficult, isn't it? But I think it's an interesting move, and obviously City, you've got City Matters, and they probably believe that that's that is the fan representation. But obviously, there's plenty of other fans who believe it isn't. So I think it can only be a good thing because if obviously there's a good deal of fans who think they're not represented, then it's worth having a conversation, isn't it? And like the original tweet said, it might take a while to get some traction with the club, so it will be interesting to see how the club react to it and if it's recognised and where it goes on from here, because City's kind of supporter movements are very different to other clubs, and again I understand that in the aftermath of the Super League, City fans weren't protesting against the owners, and I don't know why.
It doesn't take a genius to work out why.
Back to the simple reasons, it's fucking obvious why. Simple as that. But in terms on matters like this where it's affecting the match going experience or it's affecting how much money you're paying unnecessarily, then it's better to have something than to not. So it'll be interesting. I'll do more work on it in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it, see where it goes. That's it for this week's Why Always Us. Thanks as always to Sam Lee.
Thanks very much.
We'll be back again next week with the reaction to all the big stories from the Leipzig and Southampton games. You can sign up to The Athletic right now with a 33% discount. Just use the code MANCITYPOD.
The Athletic.